Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. So we've got a lot of other things, but let me go through all of the obligatories because we kind of have a stack of those. And sometimes it tends to take up half the show just because these are really, really, really rudimentary, but they're really, I mean, how big is that debt is fraud? I mean, everybody is captivated with the fact that, wow, we owe that money when actually we don't. We have other obligatories like learning, and the whole point of the show is the content, going through these founding documents, these instrumental documents. As a matter of fact, today we're going to go through the Louisiana Purchase, and there's a bunch of things that are really important that we're going to learn about the Louisiana Purchase, and even I'm throwing in an amendment from Thomas Jefferson, because in 1803, Thomas Jefferson recommended the Constitution be amended so that he would be able to do what he was envisioning that would be best for America as the president. So Congress rejected it. Anyway, when we start learning, the whole point is, you know, we're learning here. Well, as you learn and you start understanding how the framers really defined the Constitution, as you realize how much of what the government is doing is not legitimate, then the charge for anybody and everybody who makes appeals to heaven is to basically pray on those things that you've learned and what to do about them, and then act upon those things that you have received. You know, you need to do this and act. So that's why we say learn, pray, and act. Now, you could say pray, learn, pray, act, because I would also recommend that you should pray before you read the scriptures. You should pray before everything you do. And then as you learn, after you've finished learning, then pray about what you've learned and then act. So the point is, this is all about an appeal to heaven. This is what John Locke stated, that when we're at a point where our appeals to government go unanswered, then we must appeal to heaven. Now, I know a lot of people have been appealing to heaven, but they have not been appealing to heaven because, let me just say it this way. Many people just basically have prayed and asked to deliver America, but we actually have a responsibility. We were actually given responsibilities, and if we don't learn what those responsibilities are and what we need to do, because it is not the Lord to save governments. It is not our Creator's job to, you know, help us with our problems in governing. He gave us a system. He inspired this system to be established. And so you need to learn what it is, because he gave us everything we need to do to take this system back. That is what you have to act upon, because he may have saved his people from bondage and he guided them on how to govern themselves. But when they wanted to get away from the rule of kings and this the fundamental theocracy of Israel, well, then they had kings because the people chose to move down a different path. And we created a new path. Now, we were given a path that was fixed. In other words, when you look at the Constitution and the fact that the government is doing things they don't have the authority, we can get them into the authority. The only thing that's keeping them in doing the things that they don't have the power to do is we're not acting. We have to act. We have to call them out. We have to demand full compliance of the Constitution. It's pretty simple, folks. It's really simple. It is in our it is our responsibility to actually fix these problems. He gave us everything we needed. And I've been saying that for I don't know how long. So anyway, learn, pray, and act. Or pray, learn, pray, and act. Anyway, The whole point of everything is demanding full compliance of the Constitution. So if you look, the way I've kind of lined up these obligatories all kind of feed into this whole point that it's all about getting them to comply. Stop accepting what they're doing is legitimate. They don't have the legitimate authority to do 90% of what they're doing. They don't have the ability to enforce their own laws. That's for us, the militia. We need to make the militia a good word again. As a matter of fact, it is our word. It is the people's word, because the militia is we, the people. That's the empowerment of us. We have the responsibility of ensuring that the supreme law is being enforced, not the tyranny, not enforcing laws that they've assumed, only those laws. And the reason they created their own enforcement branches is because they knew that the militia wouldn't enforce unconstitutional laws. So they severed that responsibility. They created full-time mercenaries. And over time, the mercenaries have been able to grow. And actually, they've created what I would call a direct warfare by American citizens of America to American citizens. Because when you look at who are these people in these enforcement agencies, the FBI and so, they're Americans. And they've convinced them that they have all this authority that they don't have. And we've allowed them to amass that authority. They're running roughshod over us. And we have to stop that. We have to stand up and say, hey, look, you don't have the authority to even wear that uniform. As we learn, pray, and act, we need to start standing up and demanding full compliance of the Constitution. It is all, that is the name of the game. Assembly and petition, assembly and petition, assembly and petition. It is what we call interposition. Demanding and consistently and constantly demanding full compliance of the Constitution as defined by the framers at the time of ratification. That simple. So the other obligatory that's a little bit different that I want to keep in, you know, want to keep that ball in the air. let's put it that way. As I'm juggling so many different things, I am seeking you, because I'm running for president, and I'm seeking you and others to actually consider running your campaign to become an elector. We've got to take the Electoral College back. The party has absconded it. They don't have any constitutional authority to have and control the electors and choose the electors. The electors are to be chosen by we, the people. That's the whole point of this campaign. If we're going to take the election back, we have to actually get our electors back. The parties have been controlling us. The reason we're in all of these problems is because the party, because the court, because the corporations, because the executive, they're all amassing powers and working together to basically control us in every facet and every way. Because the executive, he has these standing armies that is levying warfare upon us. We see people constantly being arrested in Iowa just recently, and now in Massachusetts via Texas. There are all sorts of tyrannical arms that are going around, and they're injecting themselves into parental rights and so forth. This is happening in Washington. Folks, all of this enforcement is absolutely contrary to the Constitution. Every state should have adopted the concept that we, the people, would enforce those laws. As we started amending the Constitution, there was many things, the state constitutions, and creating new states, there were many things that people just didn't garner out of these documents, or actually maybe they'd never learned. Oh, well, I got this great opportunity. We're going to create the state to do these things and do it this way. And they became the heroes of the day. But as we look at them, they're actually the heels. They're the actual people that have instigated real problems that we now have to clean up. The fact is that we've never created our county governments. That's a huge problem. So my presidential campaign is all about getting people to start standing up and start demanding to take control of the government again. In so doing, we're only demanding to take control of our Constitution. Constitutions control government, and the people control the constitutions. And those constitutions are controlled at the fundamental level at the counties. because once you get the people, you know, once you get the county's constitutions and your county governments into check, then now you can take control of your state. Once we have the state in control, we take control of the federal government. And this is how we get from one to the next, obtaining compliance. But it has to start locally, because there's nothing more important than getting your county to actually stand up to tyranny. Nothing more important than that. Now, before I get into the Louisiana territory, I've talked about this before, and I can't tell you how many times in social media or what have you, there are people that are basically, you know, making these assumptions that, you know, the Bill of Rights is something that, you know, we're all protected from. The Bill of Rights were created as further declaratory, basically, clauses. In other words, okay, there's this thing called the freedom of the press, freedom of religion, and so forth, and government cannot involve itself in any of those things. Boom. That's the federal government cannot involve itself in any of those things. Done. The state government at that point in time had kind of general powers. Now, as we started rewriting the Constitution, we started creating enumerated powers. And most all state governments, I've yet to see any that really grants them very dangerous general powers. In other words, we kind of adopted some good principles and implementing the state government, but we failed again with the county. But the point is that many people don't understand the Constitution and these Bills of Rights. The Bill of Rights did not really become critical to us as people until the 14th Amendment, because it was the Bill of Rights, or I should say the 14th Amendment, that applied those privileges and immunities guaranteed by the federal government to not, you know, they can't do these things. They were then applied, the privileges and immunities guaranteed under that Constitution by the federal government was now applied to the states. In other words, no state can make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. Do you have a right from being free of search and seizure? Then they cannot provide any, you know, seizure of your property or come in and search without a proper warrant in accordance with the Fourth Amendment. And people look and go, no, no, no. And then I go, okay, so why is it that in every state of the union, if a police department comes in and grabs your stuff without a warrant and they try to drag you and prosecute you, you go free? Well, that's not because it's absolutely because of the 14th Amendment. Most people just believe that the Bill of Rights is just applied, but no, the absolute part of connecting that dot is that 14th Amendment, Section 1. And in so doing, if you understand that, then you will understand that this what we call equal protection under the law is not up for redefinition the way it was with Plessy v. Ferguson. When you look at equals are separate but equal, where a government, a state, can allow an institution to create a rule and enforce it, that if you come here and you're black, you can't sit here. You can only sit over there. Like, you know, you can only sit here on a certain location in the bus. This is the area for blacks. And they were allowed to make separate but equal. Well, hold on here. You're a U.S. citizen and you're getting on a bus. The law states that no state can make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. So if they say you can only sit here, but you can't sit there, that right there is a direct abridgment of your right to sit where you want to sit. If it's open to the public, it's one thing if this is a club. It's one thing if this is members only and they want to treat their members and segregate their members. You have the right in a membership, in a club with your own membership, to segregate men separated from women. You can do those things as a club because it's a closed society and they can do what they want. That's why the Boy Scouts were able to do what they wanted for the longest time and the courts were protecting them. It wasn't until the radicals took over the Boy Scouts and completely destroyed them. And society is ever ruining the day because we are... Basically, when we look at the hoe, the row we have to hoe, we are ruling the day that we've allowed these types of things to take down a good organization like the Boy Scouts of America. And there are other great institutions that are being taken down one at a time. They have been attacking us. They started with the framers. They started making wild assertions. There's no doubt in my mind that they've created bogus documents to basically create a level of confusion as well as a level of making it easy. They've just made it easy for anybody that wants to find something wrong or just loves the idea of a conspiracy. Aha! And I'm telling you, there's no there there. I don't care what the individual characters did. I don't care. And I tell you that because when they worked together and they talked and they laid out and defined what they did together, that is what happened. That is what is. Whatever they did, regardless of whether they, you know, courted a woman of unsavory character, I don't care. I don't care. What matters to us is what they did, how they did it, and how it was defined. That's what we have. That is the foundation of the government. Every man has their own problems. Every woman, we all had. I mean, we just celebrated the atonement because we're all rife with sin, faults, and make mistakes. So bottom line, what we have is we have a very specific system that was created. It was very specifically explained, and it is as harmonious as probably any other great work of science and natural science of how things just work, like, you know, the whole environment working with positives and negatives and the creation itself. Our Constitution and the creation of the Constitution is a wonder. It is something that scientists have looked at and looked at and looked at and go, oh my gosh, you know, we can't explain how these men came up with that system. They didn't have the inherent and innate knowledge of doing these things. But the way they stumbled into it and the way it came through in the arguments, we're going through this with the Constitutional Convention now. But the point is that the Bill of Rights were further declaratory restrictions placed upon the federal government. When the 14th Amendment came along, those same restrictions were now applied upon the states. So very few people understand this. Some people even look at, oh, well, look, when they created, what came out of Congress were 12 articles. They were separate articles. Yes, they were separate articles, but not one of those articles was attached to the Constitution. And the process of attaching a ratified amendment was going to be done so as an amendment to Madison. I've said this time and time again. Madison argued that they actually integrate the language into the Constitution. Ergo, the 11th Amendment would have actually changed Article 1 or Article 3, Section 2. The 12th Amendment would have actually changed Article 2, Section 1. So that when you made the changes, it would only change the words. I've actually talked heavily about the 17th Amendment. The 17th Amendment would have only changed Article 1, Section 3, if I remember correctly. It only changed a very small part of the Constitution, of how senators were chosen and how they would be replaced. That's it. That's all it changed. So had we actually done what Madison stated, what he argued for in the committee and lost, I don't know why Madison at the very beginning, he just had problems getting people to see things his way after the ratification. I mean, he was very influential in getting the Constitutional Convention moving. He was very influential in the Constitutional Convention. He was very influential in the ratification debates. But in Congress, there were lots of egos in those rooms, and they felt intimidated by the father of the Constitution. And so there's no doubt in my mind they wanted to vote away from what Madison wanted to do. They wanted to aggrandize power, as Madison was saying, no, hold on, we got to place a check on this. You can't do this. Usually, Madison would prevail, but it came at a lot of effort on his part in Congress to actually argue, and on and on and on. So anyway, this is how my obligatories take up the full first segment. So when I get into, and I'm going to do that now, when I get into this thing called the 14th, or not the 14th, the treaty on the Louisiana Territory, as we go into this, what we want to do is Friday when I come back, I'm really going to skim over the bullets of the obligatories, and we're going to cover this in more detail so that I can get through this, because this is right here, this is 6 pages of reading. And on top of that, we also have the amendment that we want to cover that Thomas Jefferson wanted Congress to pass. Now, in the beginning of acquiring this land, this became a temptation, like the flame for the moth. Being able to obtain and double the size of the Union with this single purchase, and they were looking at, wow, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money for any person. But they realized by this point in time, after 10 years, that the way the federal budget was going and the amount of money they were spending, you know, a few million dollars was actually nothing. And so they realized that, you know, they needed to do a few things that were going to help benefit the Union. And this became, you know, the deal of the century. Alaska was another one, buying that from Russia. But the point is in the Constitution, they did have the responsibility of admitting states into the Union. If there was adjoining land, was it enumerated in the Constitution for them to basically buy land? Well, they were responsible in the enumerations to have the responsibility of buying land from states to set up forts, magazines, and so forth. But in dealing with other countries and actually having the responsibility over the territories of the United States in ensuring their integration into the Union, because when you look at Article 4, Section 3, the federal government doesn't have the power to admit states into the Union. They have the responsibility of transitioning territories into states, and that the states would become sovereign and equal parties to the compact with the other states. Now, the federal government started mucking with that and actually started violating Article 4, Section 3 in the admission of states. But the concept of acquiring more land to admit more states became, because at this point in time, we're talking about early 1800s. At this point in time, the federal government was able to basically apportion taxes out to the states so that they could have some revenue coming in. The more states they would have, the more revenue. So they started realizing, wow, this is going to be a windfall. Because as we bring more states into the Union, we'll actually have more money to do things. As you look at this design, it became the perfect combination of the ability of moving this Constitution and this new formed government of a union of states, independent and sovereign states, to actually become a global entity. But as we started growing and as it took time to admit states into the Union and as time progressed, the nefarious or those with machinations wanted to pervert and subvert this concept of bringing more and more states into the Union, and they wanted to actually control and move states under their control. And by doing that, those were all violations of the Constitution. We'll get into that. But when we come back, I will start reading the introduction to the Louisiana Purchase. We'll be right back after this.
Yeah. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let's dive into the Louisiana Purchase of 1803. Now, there were lots of people running around, well, how can they do this? How can they do this? Well, obviously via treaty. Is the power enumerated for them to be the shepherds of land? Absolutely. So could they spend money to actually buy land to grow? If the union was going to benefit, absolutely. So in other words, it was easily handled as a treaty. And what Jefferson wanted to do was to be able to grant some of this land to the Indian tribes, which is why he wrote out a very long amendment in 1803, and Congress rejected it. They didn't want to have anything to do with giving land to the Indians. And then down the road, they started doing that and creating nothing but unconstitutional problems because, as Jefferson pointed out, the federal government didn't have the authority to grant U.S. land or federal land or union land, whether it be a state or what have you, because states couldn't even do it. So what really happened is they created a huge, I guess in the old days down in the South, they call it a hot mess. The federal government deliberately was going around creating hot messes for many states because they started putting reservations out into the West where these areas were going to become states. And their plan was that they would continue to hold that land. Well, those types of lands are not within the federal constitution. It's one thing to create a territory and have the responsibility of the territory and create a reservation in that territory at that point in time. But once the state becomes a sovereign state, it is a sovereign and independent state. All land within that state becomes state land. And what the federal government wanted to do was, oh, no, 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 we're going to control that land because down the road they'll be able to use it as leverage one way or the other. And that's what the federal government started learning, using leverage and playing these games one side against another and so forth. Anyway, the introduction to the Louisiana Purchase. In this transition with France, signed on April 30th, 1803, the United States purchased 828 million square miles of land of the Mississippi River for $15 million. Now, I don't know what the budget was, but if I remember, I saw the budget the very first year, or the first 2 years, it was in the multiple millions already. For roughly 4 cents an acre, bottom line, the United States doubled its size, expanding the nation westward. Originally, negotiators Robert Livingston, and I believe Robert Livingston was from New York, James Monroe from Virginia, were authorized to pay France up to $10 million solely for the port of the New Orleans and the Floridas. However, when they were offered the entire territory of Louisiana at an area larger than Great Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and Portugal combined, the American negotiator swiftly agreed to a price of $15 million. So in other words, they had a blank check that said 10, and they were offered something more that was even greater value for $5 million more. Although President Thomas Jefferson was generally a strict interpreter of the Constitution, now, again, this is from the government website, so I'm going to be reading their view of strict interpretations and so forth. Interpreter of the Constitution who wondered if the U.S. government, and especially the president, was authorized to acquire new territory, the desire to expand the United States across the entire continent trumped his ideological beliefs. As Napoleon threatened to take back the offer, Jefferson squelched whatever doubts he had and prepared to occupy a land of unimaginable riches. The Louisiana Purchase was one of the first major secessions of land in a long series of expansions that spanned the 19th century. Within 50 years, the present-day borders of the contiguous United States would be solidified with the Gadsden Purchase. Within 50 years. So in other words, by 1850, the United States would have all, actually just a couple of years after 1850, would actually own all the territory that we see the 48 contiguous states to be today. Why is this important? Why am I breaking from this for a second? Because in 1849, the federal government, because now that we have all this land, now it just needs to be mapped into territories to become states, and that those states would then join the Union. And it would all be over, that the states would step in and start controlling everything, that they would have full cognitive authority over their land per the Constitution. Well, the federal government in 1849 created this Department of Home. It's what we call the Department of Interior today. And by this point in time, by 1849, the federal government was claiming soil rights. The federal government was claiming all sorts of things that were not enumerated nor amended to the Constitution for them to meddle with. Therefore, the reason that they created this Department of Interior was they had every intention to take full control, manipulate, and control the states moving forward. Even though the eastern states didn't see how this was actually going to backfire and actually affect them as well, they just said, you know what? This is kind of what we wanted to do in the Constitutional Convention, was to create a diminished sovereignty of the western states. This is great. And it's all been done unconstitutionally, and now everybody is basically, you know, gnashing of teeth and wailing and so forth. Hey, this is tyranny. Absolutely, because when you look at what they're doing to all of the states today, it is tyranny. So, moving on, this is basically after the Gadianton Purchase. Each expansion, though greatly increasing the size of the United States, also exposed the sectional weakness between the North and the South, especially related to the issue of slavery. As new territories, we talk about this all the time, as new territories and states were created, the desire to maintain a balance between free states and slave states required a series of fragile compromises, notably the Missouri Compromise and the Compromise of 1850. Eventually, as agreements became more difficult to achieve, civil war became inevitable. Now, here's an interesting thing. When you look at the Mason-Dixon line is actually the southern border of Missouri. So Missouri was brought into the Union as a slave state, and they forced that, and this was all done by the money of the southern states. We've been going through the Constitutional Convention showing how all of the men in that room knew that the southern states had the money. They were going to be able to purchase, and buy the government that they wanted. And that the northern states were going to be basically leverage to having to fight whatever wars needed to be fought because the southern states couldn't fight. So they were going to pay for the wars, and the northern states were going to die for the wars. Tell me who the big loser was. Anyway, as we move on, in addition, the Louisiana Purchase ignored the potential impact on Native Americans. Now, I'm going to wonder, I haven't read this, I bet you they don't mention Thomas Jefferson's penning that amendment in 1803. Let's see. In addition, the Louisiana Purchase ignored the potential impact on Native Americans. The land ceded in this agreement and later expansions was populated with thousands of American Indians across dozens of tribes. As territories and states were established, more and more Americans from the east traveled west, leading to conflict with Native Americans. Ultimately, Native people were forcibly removed on to reservations, losing vast acreages of their tribal lands. So, now, to be clear, they call these lands tribal lands, but actually the Indians did not possess land. They didn't think that they owned land. You didn't think you could own land. So when we first got here, they recognized that, hey, you know, these people think they can own land and control it. Now, their paradigms may have shifted and said, hey, you know, we want to hold this land for ourselves. But their ideology was that the land was to be free and that all could use. And actually, when they saw the white people coming in hordes and numbers, that became boggling to them. Wow, look at how many more are coming. There's a lot of things that I could get into ideologically, but the point is this, is that the Indians felt threatened and they started actually posturing and pushing back, fighting back, and what have you. And the American settlers had the brunt of the cavalry out there to protect them. And so they knew that they had the weight of superior fire that could actually get them what they wanted. So these people, you know, because power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So these people actually started acting corrupt and behaving with absolute corruption. Over time, the federal government ended up managing and creating a system they had no authority to manage and create. And had we actually maintained the paradigm of a limited and defined government, and as we started moving forward, there would have had to have been a point of time where the states would have had to, each state would have had to figure out how to deal with this, which means we would have probably had 40 different solutions, or maybe 37 or 32 different solutions, whatever they would be, that how they dealt with the problem would have been differently. Regardless, it was a state issue, and it should have maintained as a state issue. But when Andrew Jackson decided to move the Cherokee out of the South and across the Trail of Tears and killing thousands of them, then that means that the federal government had completely abandoned, by that point in time, the federal government completely abandoned how they were going to, you know, work. And as a matter of fact, I even pointed this out in Why Counties Matter Most, how the government vacillated back and forth from a hostile to a cooperative to a hostile to a cooperative. And the original intent, the nation's original intent, was to actually be a land of liberty for all. And what they should have been doing was they should have been helping and nurturing the natives into becoming a civil society. Now, many of them actually believed that they were a civil society, that they believed that they're, you know, who are we to say we had a better society? Well, we had wheels, we had gunpowder, we had technology. We were a society in the making of great things because we were an innovative society. The natives of America, Africa, all of the world, when we look at the indigenous people throughout the world, they were not innovative. They became, I'll just say, they lived their life on their laurels. This is how we do things. they didn't establish a language. They didn't establish a written language. In other words, for whatever reason, they were very idle in any type of growth. They stuck to a very closed paradigm. And in other words, the concept of the time was that they were heathens. They were people that, not that they were sinner heathens, but it's a difficult and complex problem that was actually playing out. But what would have been best is to allow the states to manage it differently, because I'll bet you anything, there have been one or two states that would have done it ideally and would have been able to actually create a much better condition where the two societies could start working together. That's what Jefferson was trying to do by giving them their written language. This is why he started hosting Native Americans or the Indian tribes at the White House, so that he could go through their language and help them so that they could start documenting their history. And all of that was lost as he left the White House. But anyway, so the land seceded in this agreement and later expansions was populated with thousands of American Indians across the dozen tribes. As territories and states were established, more and more Americans from the East traveled west, leading to conflict with the Native Americans. Ultimately, Native Americans were forcibly moved. I've already read this, but the point is they were forcibly moved, losing vast acreage of what they called tribal lands, and the U.S. government would force them into changing their ways of life and try to erase their religions and cultural heritage. Now, I find this a little bit preachy. There may have been points in time where people in government, but you can't say that the U.S. government would force them to change their ways, because Thomas Jefferson didn't, Washington didn't, Madison didn't. There were, so it vacillated based on the occupants of the White House and his views of foreign policy as well as domestic policy. The Louisiana Purchase Agreement is made up of the Treaty of Cession and the two conventions regarding the financial aspects of the transaction. Okay, so now we hit the treaty between the United States of America and the French Republic. The President of the United States of America and the First Consul of the French Republic, in the name of the people of in the name of French people, desiring to remove all source of misunderstanding relative to the objects of discussion mentioned in the second and fifth articles of the convention of the eighth, and it says Vandelmeyer in and nine, which is French, and I'm going to really mispronounce this stuff, which basically in parentheses is explained as 30 September 1800. Relative to the rights claimed by the United States in virtue of the treaty concluded at the Madrid 27 October 1795 between His Catholic Majesty and the said United States, and willing to strengthen the union and friendship at the time of the said convention, was happily reestablished between the two nations, have respectively named their plenipotentiaries, to wit, the President of the United States, by and with the advice of and consent of the Senate of the United States, basically making Robert R. Livingston Minister Plenipotentiary of the United States and James Monroe Minister Plenipotentiary and an envoy extraordinary of the said states near the government of the French Republic, and the First Consul of the name of the French people, citizens Francis Barbe Marbois, I'm just mispronouncing it, Minister of the Public Treasury, who after respectively in exchanged their full powers and have agreed to the following articles. Now, what this does, this points to a treaty that was concluded at Madrid on the 27th of October, 1795. Well, guess what, folks? GR wants to know what that treaty stated, because obviously this is where we were building America by buying virtue or basically claiming land and trying to assert more control over the land around us. It is always in a nation's best interest to control the land around you. And as a matter of fact, when you think strategically, if the inhabitants of the land actually are starting to make, because the British come along and make treaties with these inhabitants, regardless of who they are, and all of a sudden those inhabitants take up arms with the British to attack us, you know, it is in our best interest to control these lands around us and create protective measures, if not strategic measures, of enveloping those lands until we actually have a good natural boundary. I mean, when you look at China, the mountains are a natural boundary for China. As we look at the United States, from sea to shining sea. So now we only had two borders to really be concerned with, the Canadian border and the Mexican border. And as we were helping galvanize Mexican liberty and the Mexican independence in the early 1800s, that's where, you know, we were able to create a respect between the two nations. Now, there's always been this disrespect between us and Britain, and with Canada being a Commonwealth of Britain, but being civil and gentlemen, there's always been this below the breath, you know, in the undertones and undercurrents, there's always this strained relationship. Even though we are considered allies, we work together, there's always those are the guys that got away, those are the guys that think they're better than us. It's always that crap. Anyway, Article 1 of the treaty. Whereas by the article, the third of the treaty concluded in St. Ildefonso, the ninth Vladimir, I'm going to have a problem with all the French. I don't speak French. And 1st October 1800, between the First Council of the French Republic and His Catholic Majesty, it was agreed as follows. His Catholic Majesty promises and engages on his part to cede to the French Republic 6 months after the full and entire execution of the conditions and stipulations herein relative to His Royal Highness, the Duke of Parma the colony or province of Louisiana with the same extent that it now has in the hand of Spain and that it had when France possessed it and such. So this was a three-way treaty. As such, should be after the treaty subsequently entered into between Spain and other states. So in other words, Louisiana, or the New Orleans more specifically, that landmass right there at the mouth of the Mississippi was considered the Catholic Spain territory. And so they had control over this. Well, to get what we wanted was we wanted that port. We wanted that control over the mouth of the Mississippi. Well, I think it became logical for anybody such as Napoleon to consider, well, you know what, or the French to consider, well, you know, we got all that land beyond that. Once you buy that port, it's going to make that land worthless to us. So why don't we make a deal on that so that you can have it, but we at least make money off the fact that, you know, you're going to be able to control the land up that river. And so that's how it ended up migrating from a $10 million for a city and a port or a small mass of land at the mouth of the Mississippi. And what ended up happening was it grew into this large landmass purchase. Okay, so whereas in pursuance to the treaty and particularly of the third article, the French Republic has an incontestable title to the domain and to the possession of the said territory, the First Council of the French Republic, desiring to give to the United States a strong proof of its friendship, doth hereby cede to the United States in the name of the French Republic forever and in full sovereignty the said territory with all its rights and appurtenances, whatever, however you pronounce that. Let me see, what is the synonym to that? Accessories, the trappings, the trimmings. So, appurtenances, anyway, as fully in the same manner as they have been acquired by the French Republic in virtue of the manner above mentioned treaty concluded with his Catholic Majesty. Okay, so Article 2. In the cession made by the preceding article are included the adjacent islands belonging to Louisiana, all public lots and squares, vacant lands, and all public buildings, fortifications, barracks, and other edifices which are not private property. The archives, papers, and documents relative to the domain and sovereignty of the Louisiana and its dependencies will be left in the possession of the commissaries of the United States, basically the emissaries, the ambassadors of the United States, and copies will be afterward given in due form to the magistrates and municipal officers of such to the said papers and documents as may be necessary to them. Article 3. Got 2 minutes and I should be able to get this done here. The inhabitants of the ceded territory shall be incorporated into the Union of the United States and admitted as soon as possible according to the principles of the federal Constitution to the enjoyment of all these rights, advantages, and immunities of the citizens of the United States, and in the meantime, they shall be maintained and protected in the free enjoyment of their liberty, property, and the religion which they profess. So that means that they are bringing in a Catholic state, and they're going to be able to freely practice their religion, and they're going to form a Catholic state based on Roman law. We all know this, okay? So, all right, that was agreed to. Article 4, got 1 minute. There shall be sent by the government of France a commissary, a bunch of ambassadors, a couple of ambassadors, to Louisiana to the end that he doth every act necessary as well to receive from the officers of his Catholic Majesty and said country and its dependencies in the name of the French Republic, if it has not already been done, as to transmit it in the name of the French Republic to the commissary or agent of the United States. So in other words, they were going to go there, they were going to make sure everybody was on board, that this is legitimate, that the United States is now taking control of New Orleans and this landmass at the mouth of the Mississippi, including those little islands and so forth. Now, we're out of time, so we'll pick up on Friday. We'll dive right back into this, and we'll hit Article 5, so that way we can finish going through this. And I'm actually going to pick up this treaty that they referenced, the treaty concluded at Madrid of 27 October 1795. So with that, I'm hoping that as we go through this, we can kind of see how they amass this. But the real question is, how is this something that proves the Constitution is illegitimate? Because that's the big claim in this big document. I'm G.R. Mobley, we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.